Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. My name is Dr. Brad Reedy. I'm the clinical director at Evoke and also the co-founder. So I'm happy to be with you this evening. This is a topic as of late that I've really become obsessed with, the topic of being right. I've been thinking about it in so many contexts lately, and this is borrowed from a chapter in my first book, but I've updated it a little bit to reflect some of the new thoughts, ideas that I've been having. And I don't dedicate a whole chapter to it in my next book, but I do revisit it because I think it's so fundamental, the idea of being right versus being a person, being right versus being a self. It's so fundamental to this kind of two ways of raising people, of raising children, two ways of being in relationship and two ways of being in the world, that it's something that I think is really important. And I like to talk about it a lot because it's not intuitive necessarily. It's not something that we've heard or that people talk about. And because there's so much pressure in our country, in our society, in our culture, to be right and be good, right? We aspire to those ideas, that it can be something that at first, when we first hear about it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So I'm excited to start and to share this with you this evening, this updated version of the myth of being right. From the first book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, it says, rather than possessing an internal sense that we are enough, we try to be right, to mask the vulnerability of owning it, which leaves us alone on a psychological island by ourselves, right? If we're right, then we've got a crowd of people behind us, right? We have a therapist, we have researchers, we have other people's opinions in our family and in our lives. But if we're just us, if it's just how we feel, what we need, and what we want, then we're alone. And that's an extraordinarily vulnerable place to be. And we didn't have models growing up for being a person and having that be enough. We had models growing up, most of us, with the idea that you had to prove your point. It had to be justified. And there's this thing that every parent does, that every generation of parents do, that is they think they have to have it right and be right in order to enforce boundaries and to lead and to guide their children. And so what we think is the most unassailable position, the most unassailable stance to take, which is, I'm right. What we think is the most unassailable position is actually the most fragile position to be in. It's a much stronger place to say, this is how I feel and what I need, and I may be crazy or old-fashioned or ridiculous or a fool, but this is what I need in this relationship. This is my boundary. This is my standard. So that's the overarching theme. Let's talk about some of the ideas that are involved in the myth of being right. Will being right prevent my child from struggling, right? If I get it right, if I push all of the buttons, I really think probably the thing that upsets me the most in my work is that I think sometimes treatment professionals subtly shame parents. They suggest to you that if you follow these 8 steps, right, these 10 tools, if you just love them enough, set clear, confident boundaries, if we give you the equation, your children will turn out well. And while they don't make a direct comparison and say it's cause and effect, there's a strong implication. So this is a different way of thinking. This is you do the best. You put forth your truth, your thought, your feeling, your idea, and then you let go of the outcome. Why do I need to be right? Like I said, I think a lot of this comes from the way that we were raised. I was thinking about it today and thinking about myself even as a young parent and how I thought I had to be right. And unfortunately, what that did to my children in the early years of child rearing is they learned very, very clearly that they had to be right. Right? There was this unspoken competition about who was the most right. My children, all 4 of them, as a matter of fact, are expert debaters. And you can guess where they honed that skill. Because as I was growing up in my younger years, that's what I thought it was about. And I say this all the time, you know, wars are being fought on who's right and who's wrong. So it doesn't prevent the battle. It doesn't take away the conflict. It just encourages a sensibility, a way of being that doesn't nurture the self, doesn't honor the self. This is why people can't get out of abusive relationships at times, why they're unreasonably loyal at times to somebody who's abusive to them. Because that person is able to convince them that they're wrong and that the person that they're in the relationship with is right, right? They mix it all up. But if you grow up and you're cooked in the soup of being a person and being a self instead of being right, then nobody can talk you out of it because you're just, the response is, I'm not okay with this. And you don't have to make the other person wrong. It's just not okay. It's really hard to do it differently. It's really hard to create intimate and connected relationships based on anything other than the pattern of attachment in our own families of origin. We were taught without words what it meant to be a person and relate to another person. We were taught, like I always say, that when our parents were upset, that was a sign to us that we were doing something wrong. And when they were happy and proud of us, that was a sign that we were doing something right. That's what we were taught. And so we did that with our children. The problem with that way of being, with assuming that everybody's a mirror back to us, and I've said this many times, we don't distinguish when we grow up between our parents who love us and are trying to do the best for us and every other person or peer in our life. So if we learn that when somebody that we're in a close relationship with us is upset, then we're doing something wrong, you can see how that gets people into problems in relationships and with peer pressure and with toxic relationships, right? We can see that very obviously. And I'll go back to something that I didn't touch on. I forgot to use this word. The idea that if parents get it right and check out off all the boxes, that their children will turn out just fine. And really what that does is it reduces our children to objects. It's called objectification, right? They don't have choice and agency in that equation. They are merely the sum total of our actions. Now, I talk a lot about impact and influence, contributions that we can make in our relationships, but it's very different than describing it as simple and utter control over another person. It's fundamentally different. So that's important. Sometimes we can be distracted by the wrong co-parent, right? And that's one of those topics that I have so much difficulty in responding to, because the fact of the matter is that if you are in a relationship with a co-parent who's not on board, a co-parent who's sabotaging, who's not supporting this different way of being that treatment is asking for, if you are in a relationship with somebody like that, it's so easy to be distracted by them, to be thrown off balance. So it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of effort to stay on your side of the street. There's this saying, you know, we've heard this advice. I heard this advice as young as I can remember. Don't go to bed angry. That's silly. If I didn't go to bed angry sometimes, we would have some long fights late at night. One of the first tools you learn as somebody that's teaching and dealing with people who have anger issues is to take time out to sleep on it. But there's that saying, don't go to bed early angry, excuse me, it teaches a principle, again, in our culture that goes largely unquestioned, which is that the answer is consensus. That's not the answer to intimacy. I share this quote from a wedding I went to many, many years ago, where an old timer stood up to at the wedding breakfast to give a toast to, I think, his great niece and her new husband. And he said, if you're not fighting, one of you is an idiot. And so he's saying that the joining of two selves that have some sense of themselves, they're going to have some conflict. They're going to have some difficulty kind of negotiating and finding out where that balance is. I thought about it in terms of parental examples of the myth of being right. You know, statements and comments that are more focused on things that parents think and do. It seems like we're making a good point and that we're building a strong foundation, but proving, justifying, and explaining for your boundaries. The implication there is to the child is, I have to be right. You have to understand. I have to convince you, move you toward my way of thinking. And it's a lot harder to say, I don't know. This is my best guess, or this is what I feel comfortable with, but I don't know for sure if it's a mistake. In fact, if I'm quite honest with you, I sometimes lose sleep at night thinking I don't know how to do this. But I know I have to do something because I'm responsible. But I don't want to sit here and suggest to you that I'm right. And think about that for a moment. Think about the wonderful model that is for your child and how it begins to teach them that they can go out in the world and have the same kind of relationship with other people. They don't have to convince their abusive boyfriend or girlfriend that they're abusive and that the boundary that they're trying to set is justified. They can just say, this is what I think and feel. Arguing or debating, similar, right? Trying to move the other person over to your idea, your way of thinking, consensus. Because again, if we convince people that we're right, if that's the idea, then we don't really have to set a boundary. If I can convince you that what I'm saying and doing and wanting and expecting, my rules, whatever they are, if I can convince you that they're right, they're correct, then you're just going to choose them and I don't have to set a boundary, which is the hardest thing to do in relationships in many ways. I put this on here, learning to laugh at yourself and not take yourself too seriously. This is not, when I teach this parenting stuff, it's not about creating a minefield where you step the wrong direction and everything's going to blow up. It's not that. It's just learning to understand that you're just a human being. I heard the Dalai Lama speak a year and a half ago or so at the University of Utah. And in the sweetest way, he kept making jokes about himself. They actually gave him a visor, University of Utah visor, and this big medallion. And, you know, they were trying to be very respectful and very formal to him. And he put the visor and the medallion around his neck until it got too heavy and he had to take it off. But he kept the visor on the entire time. This simple little tennis visor, it looked like. He tripped when he was walking up the stairs just a little bit. And he laughed at himself and he said, wouldn't that be funny if I fell down? The more comfortable we become with ourselves, the more work that we do, the more able we are to laugh at ourselves. Narcissists can't laugh at themselves, right? Fragile people can't laugh at themselves. This is a confusing concept, this next one, but it's important. Trying to be a good parent is the enemy of becoming a better parent. Because if you try to be a good parent, then what happens is everything becomes in the service of you being good. Your children can't be mad at you. They have no right to be mad at you because you're good. So the way that you show up in the world, in the way that others have to show up with you in the world, is that to support the idea of that you're good. But if you just get to be a self, you know, the amazing secret to all of this, if everybody could just accept that they're kind of bad, the world would be more moral. It would be more compassionate. There'd be fewer wars and fighting. There'd be more kindness and love in the world. Because I wouldn't be spending all of my emotional and psychological resources to try to be something that I already am deep down inside. Somebody said to me the other day, I forget where I was, but somebody said, I wish everybody could just realize that everybody's crazy in one way or another. And I jokingly responded and said, I'm trying to get the word out the best I can. If we all could just embrace our crazy, horrible, rotten self, we could be free to love instead of trying to be good and trying to project that image and fighting for the label of being good. There's a difference between trying to make somebody feel loved, for example, and loving. Loving is the thing that comes out of me to other people. But trying to make you feel loved is controlling and me taking something from you. I need something from you. Loving is a giving thing. My need for you to feel a certain way is a taking thing. So loving and trying to make somebody feel loved is different. Being fair-minded and trying to make somebody think that you're fair are two different projects. Accepting somebody is different than making them feel like they belong and you haven't rejected them or abandoned them. You have to learn how to lose, right? You can't win. You can just choose how to lose. Choose with authenticity and compassion and kindness and love. Anytime you start an idea or a sentence with, I just want them to feel, you're in trouble. This is also in my first book, this cartoon. The parents, of course, holding the child psychology book behind their backs to show that they've been trying. Looking down at their young son and saying, don't you realize, Jason, that when you throw the furniture out the window and tie your sister to a tree, you make mommy and daddy very sad. Right? That's how we were taught to raise children. And then you get into programs like ours and other programs and you get the I feel statement. You think, well, now I'm just going to do it even better. But that's not really what it's for. So we learn to speak relatively. This is what I feel, think, believe, value. This is what I want. You know, we start to parent consistently from this is what I feel comfortable with. And then when your kid says you're wrong, your response is maybe so. It's the difference between being a self, modeling being a self, being a person with your children, and trying to figure out who's right. And teaching children that there's a right way to be in the world ensures their failure. And I know it sounds counterintuitive because we want our children to be loving, compassionate, generous, kind, authentic, giving, sharing people. Right? We want that. But being right isn't the way to teach it, to model it. Being a person is. Being a self is. We use I feel statements, but not to get other people to change. And that's why I say, as of late, that it's very rare that I'm going to encourage a parent to share with their child how they feel. Because number one, almost always the implied message is to the child, you need to feel something you need to do something else so I feel better. Or how I feel is a reflection of how you're doing. And that's just not okay. It's not setting them up to have meaningful lives and to be connected to other people. Listening doesn't mean endorsing or agreeing. You don't have to agree with your child, but you can listen. And it's hard at first because when people shift from not listening, trying to talk the child out of it or convince the child to feel or think something different, and then they shift into listening, people really do hear, the children hear, that, well, you're endorsing it. But over time, as you shift, people will understand that it's not necessarily an endorsement. I see this in our field all the time. My work with the kids is I'll go out there and they'll say things to me like, I had this one boy come up to me. I've told this story before. He came up to me and this story has been repeated versions of it hundreds of times, thousands of times. This boy came up to me and I'd been told by the staff in my summary of the group that he was a really entitled young man. So took that with a grain of salt, but he walked up to me at some point during my field time with him and he said, I hear that you're the owner of this place. I said, I'm one of them. He said, so you have some influence. And I said, yeah, I can decide some things. He said, I would like to make a couple of requests. And I said, okay. And he said, I would like to exchange the M&Ms in our trail mix for Skittles. And I said, okay, what else? He said, I would like to advocate for another meat night, another night where fresh meat gets sent out to the field. And I sat there and I said, okay. He said, thanks for listening. And he walked away. He didn't come in like that, right? But he started to learn, at least in this context, at least with us. He could share, ask for, make requests, and we could listen. And we didn't have to do that old fight, that old battle. Learning to connect and see your children is the thing, right? It's the most important thing. Learning to connect to them. Avoid using anger, fear, guilt, shame to control them. It's very tempting. Because intimidating and using shame are really, really, really effective behavior modification devices. Really effective. They're what I use when I'm not aware, when I'm depleted, when I just don't have enough capacity to see or to hear my children, and avoiding control. We learn to ask for what we need. Clean your room for me, not because it's the right thing to do. In other words, I say to my children, like, I'm kind of OCD. I don't know if I really am OCD, but I don't really care. And I say, so I'm OCD, so this is how clean the house has to be. And then they say, you're crazy. And I say, you have no idea. You have no idea how crazy I am. I don't argue with them. I tell them I'm old-fashioned. And I don't have all the same rules as everybody else, even my wife. Right? But we're allowed to have our boundaries. I like this idea of asking a child for a hug, not giving them a hug. Can I have a hug? Because, you know, adolescents that are angry and feeling alienated, they need a hug. But they have a hard time asking for it. If you ask them if they want one or need one, but you can just ask for one. You can just own your need. Learning to model and to teach that feelings themselves are enough. Doesn't mean that everything they feel they get, but they're allowed to feel it. And they don't have to prove that they're right, or we don't have to show them how they have thinking errors or distorted reasoning. We don't have to turn into their cognitive behavioral therapist. We can just understand it. Own your human limitations rather than making the other person wrong or making it about them. Right? It's about, again, modeling self. Carl Jung has a famous quote that says, I would rather be whole than good. Right? Good is a sliver of us. Good is limiting. But wholeness means that sometimes I'm sad, sometimes I'm angry, sometimes I'm hurt, sometimes I'm self-centered, sometimes I'm generous, kind, and loving. And the more we're allowed to be a whole, the more that we can heal and integrate. And this is not a pathway toward hedonism or selfishness, but on the contrary. That's what the Dalai Lama talks about, and even the Catholic Pope is talking about. Kindness and relationships matter. The dogma and the doctrine is not the thing. It's love that's the thing. And there are other religions too. I don't mean to just those first two that came to mind. I love this quote. I saw it last week. Don't know who said it because there was nobody signed, but I think about it in terms of parenting our children. The quote goes like this. The first thing you should know about me is that I am not you. A lot more will make sense after that. That's what it is. You know, when parents say, I don't understand why she does this, you know, there's people in our culture that are talking about public figures these days saying, I don't understand why he does it or she does it. We see that phrase all the time. It's just a subtle way of shaming somebody. It's just a way of saying you're crazy or stupid. So we learn to see other in this way. When we become a self, when the project is being a self, we can see other selves. When the project is being right and good, we can't see other people. We reduce people to objects, to symptoms, to behaviors. The origin of self-esteem is really connection, resonance, right? There are a lot of pieces of it, but being seen is what makes the self meaningful. Resonance is what makes the thoughts and feelings of somebody meaningful. When somebody gets, I hear lots of people talk about, you know, looking at homeless people and giving them the dignity, right? They get ignored. We're uncomfortable. I have a friend who does a carnival at Skid Row every year, Justin Baldoni. He's a fantastic example. When I walk down the street with him, he'll often greet a homeless person. He might not give them money, but he'll give them a hug or ask how they're doing. And so once a year, now he has this foundation, he goes to Skid Row in Los Angeles, and he has a day where people donate goods and services to these folks. He's giving them their dignity. Mentalizing is the idea that I can imagine what life is like where you sit. I can imagine what you're thinking and feeling, what the goal is in your behavior. So again, that statement about I don't understand why they're doing what they're doing, that's just a limitation of yours. It's okay. It's not bad. It's just a limitation. So that's your project, right? That's part of what you get at Evoke Therapy programs is you get a therapist that says, this is why they're doing what they're doing. I know it looks irrational and unreasonable, but let me tell you what I think they're getting out of it. And that's so helpful to discover. It automatically shifts our feelings of toward compassion and speaks often to how we might respond that would be helpful. We model self-care. That's the hard work. And self-care will feel guilty for you. You will feel selfish. It'll feel like the wrong thing, right? Again, because what prevents you from self-care is trying to be good. But we model pressing through the guilt and practicing self-care. And then we take care of ourselves so that when we show up to the child, we're an asset to them instead of a liability. If I take care of my scared, anxious, frustrated, disappointed, rageful feelings over here in my support group or with my therapist or with my sponsor or with a trusted friend who can hear me, if I take care of those feelings over here, then when I show up to you, my child, I can be there for you instead of you needing to be there for me. And that's a very different project, a very different dynamic. We live a day at a time. We take it a day at a time because it's a hard work. And the more we do this work, I'm so much more aware of what a screw up of a parent and a husband I am than when I first got married and first had children. I knew I wasn't perfect, but I thought I'm pretty good. And I'm much better now than I was then. And I'm much, much more aware of what an idiot I am today. It's one of the things that I try to give to my children is that I'm an idiot. And they can tolerate that. It's tolerable to have an idiot mom and dad. You can live with that. It's hard to live with a mom and dad who are right. Really, really hard. Faith and fear, you know, learning that fear is really the enemy of authenticity, the enemy of creativity. And we can't just erase it just because it contributes to our lives in that way, but it's something to work on. That's why I was in New York City a few nights ago doing the parent support group there, and people were sharing their sadness, their hurt, their anxiety, their fear. And I said, after all the sharing, I said, this is the right place to talk about that. It's the right place to unload, to be heard, to be supported, to be validated. Your children aren't going to validate it. It's really not even their job. But we can do it for you so that you can go back home and have a little bit more in your belly, a little bit more spiritual and emotional energy to give. being willing to be wrong. Boundaries. This is about boundaries. You have to be willing to be wrong. You have to be willing to be hated or to have them angry. You have to be willing to lose. You have to be willing to be alone. You have to be willing to be bad. You have to find your own mirrors for self-esteem because your children can't do that for you. If they are enlisted in the service of being your mirror, they will lose important parts of themselves. They just have to be themselves. So don't look at them for a reflection of who you are. It's a problem for both of you. And again, we all do it. So, but the project is to practice is to not do it. All the while you're listening and hearing. You know, to understand another person, especially a child sometimes, you have to lose your mind. That's what one therapist taught me. You have to lose your mind to hear somebody else. Stop making it about you. Right, you go somewhere so that you can talk about you. But when you're with the child, it's not about you. That's what that gives you. So that when a child thinks you're a monster, it's laughable, right? It's like when the parents asked me at the parent support group a month and a half ago, they asked my son first, and then they asked me, were you angry at your father for sending you to wilderness? And you know, after he left the meeting, I just said, it wouldn't matter to me. Not really. It's not like I'm flawless in this area, but big picture, it didn't matter. That's not where I was. He's not my source of strength. I got people for that. I got a therapist for that. Their response and their feelings, their successes and their failures are not evidence of yours. And that's hard because our culture teaches it. Therapists in the field teach it. Treatment professionals teach it. Pop psychology teaches it. Books on parenting teach it, right? It's so hard for me when I see books that are so subtly shaming to parents. We have plenty of problems as parents. We have plenty of flaws. We have plenty of weaknesses to work on, right? It's a life's work for us to heal our own injured, scared children inside of us. We have plenty to work on. We don't need to then have what our children do to be a measure of us also, and their failures are ours, and put the pressure on them that their successes are ours too, right? That's too heavy a burden for a child to carry. This is in my book, and I got permission to share it from Doug Savage, The Three Stages of Self-Awareness. Chicken one says you're an idiot. Chicken two says no. Stage two. Chicken one says you're an idiot. Chicken two says yes. And then stage three. Chicken three just says I'm an idiot. That's really the simplest way to describe enlightenment. But most of us, because of fear, we're trying to tell the world that we know we're not perfect, but we're trying to tell the world we're pretty good, you know? This used to hang up in my therapist's office behind where she sat. And so for years, I saw this. It's a poster that she drew. It's called Words of Higher Enlightenment. And it has the list of words. I'll read some of those for those of you who are listening on the podcast app. It's also in my book. Drop out, fail, quit, lose, relax, give in, flunk, let go, empty, surrender, wait, give over, mellow out, slow down, don't forget, submit, fade away, relinquish, give up, resign, fizzle, release, bend. All the words that we would associate with failure. But enlightened folks realize all the parts of themselves because it's okay. And just because you know that you screw up sometimes doesn't really empower you or make you want to screw up more. Although most of us are motivated by shame, and so we're afraid that if we just accept all the parts of ourselves that we're going to be these lawless, lazy, self-centered individuals, right? That's what we fear. But this new sensibility, think about it. Think about people like Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King Jr. You know, think about some of the Gandhi. Think about some of the great enlightened minds. They're not selfish or self-centered. They have a healthy practice of self-care. They need to have as much capacity as they have. But they spend their entire lives because of that, being able to give. And they don't have a lot of judgment about anybody else because they're in touch with their own stuff. So the take-home message is, learn to practice being an idiot parent. If you admit that you're an idiot to your children, you will have fewer arguments. Okay? And when they accuse you of being an idiot, you just simply say to them, you have only begun to scratch the surface of my idiocies. If you knew what was hiding beneath the surface, you would probably run out of here screaming. And I'm being funny about it. I don't mean that you say that every time, but it's a surrender to, okay, I don't know your point. I'm an idiot. Like, what's your point? Okay. We walk on eggshells with our children, trying to control them, right? Trying to figure out the equation. We create this hothouse flower because we try to create the conditions because we want them to be happy and okay and not angry and not struggling. And then we create this hothouse flower kind of effect. Instead of just showing up and being us, letting go of control, telling the truth about what we feel and think, and being willing to lose. Cause and effect. It's not cause and effect, parenting. I was talking to a young man, a former student of mine from 7 years ago, just the other day. And we were just catching up and sharing about his life. And I was saying, it's really hard. It's really hard to just tell the truth, because sometimes when I've done that in my life, I've lost people. And I gave him examples where I expressed my needs in important relationships and people weren't willing to adjust. And that's not ideal. And some people were able to adjust, willing to adjust. And so over the course of a long period of time, the people that I'm around are more supportive of me. And the people that can't or won't support me in the ways that I need, they're not around as much. And it didn't just happen. It didn't happen because I went around telling people, you can't treat me that way. But went around because I set boundaries with people. And he said to me, I'm so glad you told me examples where it didn't work. Because there's this implication, if we do it right, if we do it honestly, authentically, that everything will work out. And it doesn't always work out that way. We learn to be a better person for its own reward, because it feels better. We learn to be more loving because that's a more enjoyable way to live. Not because we'll be seen as loving. Stop trying to be right. That's what this is all about. Who you are is enough. If you came to me as a client and you told me that you had a certain boundary, I might ask questions and explore it with you, but you don't have to prove by any means that you're right. In fact, the more simply you say, this is just how I feel, the easier the discussion is. We use I statements and we front load and back load ownership, meaning saying, if we do share with people, you say, you don't have to do anything about this. This is not your problem. You don't have to change. You know, the generic example I give of the wife who's leaving her alcoholic husband, splitting with her alcoholic husband, she's saying, you don't have to stop drinking. It's not my job to control whether you drink or not. In fact, I've been doing that for the first 15 years of our marriage. But I can't have this anymore. Right? And we come to learn the truth about ourselves. Not the truth, right? Most of us are taught that there's the truth and that relative ideas are lesser than. But it's really all that we have. All we have is what I feel and what I know, what I believe, what I prefer, what I value. I can't tell you your truth. I could try to manipulate you. And if you're my child, I'm going to be tempted. But I don't know my children's truths. I don't. And I have four children, and if you could talk to any one of them, these are not amoral children. These are children who have passions and very different from each other. So the outcome is authentic selves. Children who can take care of themselves. All right, send in any questions now. I'll talk about upcoming events, and then I'll take any questions at the end. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step meetings for themselves. Any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or Alateenus for Teenagers, or adultchildren.org. You can also go to recovery.org. It's a Buddhist-inspired recovery program. Or you can go to NAMI.org, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, in your community, your local chapter, for free classes and resources in your area. Follow us. You can listen to all of these broadcasts, and these are public. You can subscribe. If you do go there, please subscribe and rate us on your iOS device, on the SoundCloud, on the iOS device, that's your iPhone device, use the podcast app. And on the Android device, you download the SoundCloud app and you search Evoke Therapy Programs to find our channel and press subscribe there. You can also go on any computer to soundcloud.com and search Evoke Therapy Programs. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Evoke Therapy. You can also follow the Evoke Summit Lodge using the handle at Evoke Summit Lodge. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs. You can also find the Alumni Foundation on Facebook by searching Evoke Family Foundation. That's an organization that helps people who can't afford treatment. Our blog, there's new content each week. While the Amazon warehouse is being resupplied with my copies of my first book, second book isn't out yet. We're finishing up the editing. It'll be out later this year. You can still buy the book by going to Amazon and clicking on the new options under the paperback square. You can also buy a digital version or an audio version, but there are paper books available directly from Evoke Therapy Programs if you want to go there. If you want to do a deep dive, if anything that I say starts to make sense, and in my opinion, and I'll say it as clearly as I can, this is the most important thing you can do to contribute to your children's maintaining the gains that they get out of our program. I do this every year for myself. I go somewhere else, and I do intensive work every year for myself. So our intensives for individuals is called Finding You. It doesn't have to be just with your child. It can be any point of crisis. You don't have to have anybody at Evoke, as a matter of fact. If you're listening on the podcast app, anybody can do this. Trauma, relationship, stage of life, decisions, things like that. Anxiety, depression. Finding You, the next opening will be in April, April 10th through 14th. Go to our website or email intensives@evoketherapy.com. Upcoming Parent Support Groups, Philadelphia, no longer tentative. I'll be there Monday, April 8th. I have a midday meeting that's just Q&A and then a presentation that evening. We'll be in New York, back in New York on Monday, May 13th, and in Toronto, Wednesday, May 22nd. For more information or to RSVP, email melanie@evoketherapy.com. We ask all current parents, to go to a workshop while their child is with us, if they can. The next one is March 23rd and 24th. If you haven't signed up yet, you're probably not going to that one. So the one after that will be April 13th and 14th. But multifamily, experiential, get to interact with the staff. You can combine it with a field visit to your child if your Evoke therapist thinks it's the right timing clinically. Again, contact melanie@evoketherapy.com. Pursuits trips are custom trips designed for young adults and families. Think therapy light, sober fun, trips all around the world, all kinds of adventures. So contact our staff and ask questions about one if you'd like to set it up. All right, questions from people coming in. First comment or question. My mistake recently is acting like a victim with my child, young adult, while trying to speak up for myself. That's a new thing. I feel embarrassed and having a hard time accepting I'm not perfect. Wonderful. You're on the road. All of this is going to feel horrible at first. All of this is going to feel wrong at first. Right? It's just going to feel unnatural, wrong, unenlightened, stupid, selfish, misdirected. It's going to feel that way. Hopefully there's a glimpse of a hint in your mind of the truth of it. Enough so that you try it and know that you're almost willing to try something new because the old way wasn't working. But you're going to have those kinds of feelings. Harriet Lerner, the author of Dance of Anger, one of my favorite books on boundaries, says, you should expect and plan for change back messages. Change back to the way things were. And when you prepare for those, you're more capable of kind of going through them. And she calls the early phases of boundary setting, she calls them the obnoxious phase. Because we often don't do it well. Eggshells with our children. Our son just asked not to do this with him anymore in our last therapy session. He spent 12 weeks at Evoke and then at a residential treatment center for 6 months. We're going on our first vacation since he started treatment, spending a lot of time together, and I want to honor his request going forward. He asked me to be direct. This is hard to do, but I know I just have to let go of the outcome. Thanks for these webinars. They're so helpful. I'm glad they're helpful. And sometimes they start to feel what it's like to be treated like a person, to not be treated like they're fragile, to not be lied to or manipulated, but just have somebody show up and tell them the truth and set a boundary. And not all of them, but some of them really catch fire with it. And I've had students, the student that I met with the other day that I told you about, that I had 7 years ago in my group, he shared an example. He was telling me about the other boys in his group, and he said he remembered that one of the boys said to his father, he said, don't lie to me, just tell me the truth, and I can deal with it now. He'd asked his father about some football scores, and his father said, oh, I'm not really paying attention. And then his dad later admitted, I lied. I just didn't want to talk about it. And his son said, you can just say that. And I know you have evidence to believe that I'm not going to deal with it anymore, but I can deal with it. That I'm not going to deal with it well, because in the past I threw tantrums and argue, but I can deal with it now. And it was really, really cool. Any other questions? Comments? Nope. Looks like that's all for this evening. Thanks for joining us. I hope these are helpful points of contact. Listen to them, re-listen to them. You can also, if you're part of the parent portal, you can also go and click on the slides and download the PDF versions of any of these slides through the parent portal. The next one will be on getting the help you need and deserve. That'll be Thursday, March 28th, a week from tonight, 7 p.m. Mountain Time. Happy spring, first day of spring. Thanks for the effort that you put in to show up and for the work that you're doing for and on behalf of your children. It makes a difference. It shifts the energy. It takes weight off of their shoulders, and they're being crushed by the weight, as you know. But when you make your life the project and not their life the project anymore, it's liberating for them. Makes it a lot easier for them to do their work. All right, folks, have a great evening. Take care. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Better year you'll be. Better year you'll cover me. There's a hole inside my head, leaking at the same sense. Talk, no turn. Slowly chose.